Well, mums, let me say as well, happy Mother's Day for tomorrow. We call this the Mother's Day weekend. We want to celebrate the whole time. We've got some special flowers on stage tonight. So if you get sick of looking at me, you can look at them, and that's probably nicer. If you're a mum, can I just say, we celebrate you. Yeah, we do want to honour you. We want to acknowledge the high calling that you've given yourself to, and no doubt the high price you're paying to be a mum. We salute you, okay? And bless you. Bless you for your work. Mother's Day, you know, for all its corporate things and, you know, our society goes nuts on what you've got to buy and all that kind of stuff, but it's, of all the days that we come up with to celebrate throughout the year, I think this one's worthwhile, to remember our mothers and to celebrate them and honour them. And I certainly will be celebrating my own mum tomorrow and helping my kids rejoice in their own mother. I'll be doing that. So, fellas, make sure you help your kids do that. But as we celebrate, it is always worth acknowledging as well. In the celebration, I'm so aware that for many, it's a mixed day or mixed weekend. There's joy and celebration, but perhaps too there's some grief and there's some pain as well, as comes with many of the holidays we celebrate. Perhaps some of you have lost your mother even recently and you're feeling the pain of that. Or perhaps you've never had the kind of mother that you could easily celebrate. Or perhaps your own hopes for motherhood have been dashed because you haven't been able to have the kids you longed for, or the kids you did get to have haven't turned out like you longed they would. There's a whole bunch of reasons why Mother's Day, or just considering motherhood, can be not only something we celebrate, but something that also dredges up a huge amount of pain and grief for us. As I've been thinking about mothers this week, one reflection I've got is this, is that every mother I've ever met, at least, every mother I've ever met longs to raise healthy, happy, well-adjusted kids. And, this is the other thing I've learned, and enjoy the process of it and enjoy the relationship with the kids along the way. It's a very, very deep, deep longing that I notice in mothers. And it's something that I just, you know, wanted to put out there. But it's not just mums that have those types of deep longings for things to go well with what they give themselves to. Have you ever noticed how we all, just by nature, long for things to go well? It's kind of obvious, I know, but we long for life to work. We can't help ourselves but to seek happiness and well-being. We all, without exception, desire enjoyment and pleasure in life, and we can't help but to pursue it. We all pursue it in many different ways, but one guarantee is this, is from day one, you will pursue pleasure and enjoyment of life, and you won't stop until your days are up. And when I say pursuing pleasure or pursuing happiness, here's what I actually mean by happiness. I mean deep, lasting happiness. The kind of happiness that leads to true satisfaction and contentment in life, where you feel meaning and purpose and significance. That's the kind of happiness I'm talking about. You will pursue that your whole life. Why? Well, we've been wired this way by a God who is just like that. You can actually see, it's not in the reading from tonight, but if you've been reflecting on chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes this week in your group, you might have noticed verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time and has also set eternity in the human heart. The maker of humanity has set something in our hearts. It says here that he's set eternity in our hearts, meaning that from a very deep place, we desire everlasting good things. And we're not going to be able to help ourselves because we've been wired that way. We've been wired with deep longings for glorious things that don't end. We've been built for beauty and enjoyment and pleasure unending. We're just wired that way. And so we pursue it with our days. And if it's true, then it's no surprise at all that we look around and observe in those around us and in ourselves that we are constantly pursuing pleasure. and happiness in our lives. I actually think it's easy to see how constantly and continually we pursue pleasure by simply noticing this, how easily devastated we get when things don't go well in multiple different areas of life. We're easily devastated when things go wrong because we desperately want them to go well. And we can't help ourselves but to want them to go well. It's right to want them to go well. I'll give you one little example. Holidays. Whoever goes on a holiday and hopes that it's terrible, you know? You go on a holiday and you've got expectations. You've got desires, and it doesn't matter how hard you try to lower them, they're still there. So you go away on a family holiday, or you go away if you're not in the family zone, you go away on some kind of travelling holiday, some new experience, some new culture, maybe overseas or around our own country. And here's what I'd notice about holidays. They're just very easily frustrated, yeah? All it takes is some dodgy weather or some dodgy sickness or something that you're travelling in to break down or run late or some other kind of chaos to come in. And then all of a sudden, this wonderful picture you had for that holiday just easily gets frustrated. I call it the expectation blues, yeah? You've got expectations for how you want things to go, even if they're realistic, but you easily get the blues when it doesn't work out that way. And I've even tried to remove that expectation or even remove the desire so I'm not disappointed when things don't go well. By the way, I have just had a fantastic holiday break with my kids. It's surprising to me how well it went. But even when I try to, and I'm not sure if you'd notice this, even when you do try to lower your expectations, even when you're trying to strip back all your desire for something, you just can't remove it. And let me say this, your desire for happiness will never leave you. You'll never be able to shake it off. And if that's the case, then we do need to find out where it can be found and go after it. If we're always going to desire pleasure and happiness, where can it be found? And let's go get it. Let's spend our life pursuing it. Let's go after it. Now, to do that, I think, requires some pausing and reflecting about life. And when we come to the book of Ecclesiastes, that's what we get to do. I'm not sure how you're going with the book of Ecclesiastes. I used to call it a clickety clack sticks when I grew up because that's how I could pronounce it. So that just slips out, that's why. I find this book divides Christianity. Some people hate it. Some people love it. I'm not sure how you're going over the last few weeks, you know. Hating it or loving it does seem to divide us. But I tell you this, we trust that all of God's scriptures are useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting and training. So we will benefit by giving ourselves to this book for the days that we will have it, the weeks that we'll have it. And I tell you, here's the opportunity we have. We have the opportunity to pause down, step back from your own life, look at it, think about it, ask the big questions about the normal pursuits that we have in our life, examine our own attempts to try to make life work, and just be honest about how it's going. And come to some good conclusions and reflections. We actually live in a society that says you can get ultimate fulfillment and happiness out of life here. We live in a community that's continually giving us this message. Yeah, you can arrive. Life is here for the taking. Usually when we hear that kind of message, though, it's because something's being advertised to us, some type of product. Yeah, we get told that if you take out this kind of credit loan, then you'll be able to buy this and that and you'll be at freedom in your life. So get credit, then you'll get freedom. Or we get told, go after this diet or this kind of exercise regime and then you will finally be that person you know you dream you could be. Or buy this book and read it and follow it and you'll end up with the perfect marriage and perfect children. In fact, I looked at a book the other day, I can't remember the title exactly, but it said something like, change your kids by Friday or something like that. Is that right? 5 days, radically change your kids. And my daughter picked up the book and said, what are you trying to do to me? You don't want to change me, do you? Haven't read the book, can't comment on the book. Sure, it's fantastic. But, you know, we get promised that life can work out. And if you just do these things and get these things, you'll arrive. And we continually have it laid out to us. And so it's really easy to spend your entire life pursuing those very things, hoping that one day we'll get it. When we get that message coming at us, day in, day out, week in, week out, we've got a choice. We can either believe society and pursue happiness in those things, or we can take time to consider God's word to us And in this book here, consider the reflections of the teacher who writes the large body of the material that we're looking at here. The teacher who some assume it's King Solomon, it might be. It's certainly a King Solomon type person. But if we consider his reflections, we need to understand this is a man who has gone ahead of us and tested life in a very deep and profound kind of way. You can see that in chapter 2 from the passage we read. Come and have a look at that there with me. Chapter 2, verse 1. Here's the teacher. He says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. The teacher here is going to use all the resources that he has, his wealth and his wisdom, to do an experiment, to do a test, to test pleasure, to find out what is good, he says. Which is effectively is to test this, to see if he can make life work, see if he can actually get that deep, lasting happiness by pursuing pleasure here. Now, verse 3, have a look at that, the second half of verse 3, towards the end of it, he says, I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. So he's saying, seriously, I want to know what's worth doing with the few days I've got here. You don't have many. We don't have many. What's really worth doing while you're here? He wants to test it. And he wants to test what's worth doing in the days under the heavens. And you see this kind of language all the way through the book. He's testing a very particular kind of life. It's usually called under the sun all the way through the book, which is this. And here's that one thing you really got to get your head around when you come to the book of Ecclesiastes. This is a man testing life under the sun, which is simply to say testing the physicality of life, just testing the kind of normal pursuits we go after. Life under the sun is to consider life apart from God, without reference to any kind of deity, without listening to any kind of voice from outside us telling us what to do with our lives. Just observe the way people work, look at the kind of things we normally go after, think deeply about them and ask yourself the real question, is it working? Are we arriving at that deep, lasting happiness that we're after? And the teacher here says, I'm going to test it. I'm going to go after it. I'm going to pursue it, and I'm going to see if these things can be found. And the challenge for us is whether we will actually listen to someone who has gone before us and done an extensive experiment. I don't think we're real good at doing that, by the way. We're not real good at learning from history and seeing what people have done previous to us. If someone's had a really hard time in the past and they attempt to warn us about something, we usually tend to think, oh, well, that was you. You had a terrible time, but it'll be different for me. Yeah, have you ever done that with your parents or your grandparents where they try to warn you, you know, about how things are going to go and you're like, yeah, sure. But for me, here's how my life's going to go. Yeah? Will we listen to the teacher? Now, some of you read the book of Ecclesiastes and just think it just sounds like the ramblings of a grumpy old man. Yeah? I heard someone actually said that to me this week. It sounds like this cynical old bloke who had a bad time, and now he's just writing everything off. It's going to be a bit of a challenge for us to go into the book of Revelation. We need it. Book of Ecclesiastes, we need to trust it. Let's look at the experiment he goes on, because it's a pretty serious one. It's a serious experiment to seek pleasure and happiness. He goes after pleasure at all cost. He goes all out. He devotes himself to the cause. He's going to use all his time and his energy and his finances to basically saturate himself with every single pleasure that his eyes or his heart wants. He's just going to go and get it, and he's going to supersize it, and he's going to see if it works. Let's have actually a look at it. There's three big things he does. He actually goes after parties, he goes after projects, and he goes after a lifestyle. And it's almost the three big stages of life that we all kind of go through. Most young people want to have crazy fun, and then they grow up a bit, and they want to go after projects and work hard to establish themselves. And then in the end, they want to sit back and enjoy retirement. And the teacher here actually tests all those three areas. So he throws some epic parties. Then he actually constructs some epic projects. And then he lives an epic lifestyle and he comes to a conclusion. Will we listen to it? because it'll be more than we ever get to do with our lives. Let's look at the parties that he throws. You can pick up the kind of theme there in verse 3. He says, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me in wisdom. Now, it's just a little snippet of the kind of thing he did. But he thought, I'm going to see if this works. I'm going to drink a lot of really good wine. I'm going to do it with friends. I'm going to embrace folly. I'm going to try to have these crazy parties, and I'm going to try to enjoy myself day after day, night after night, and see if that works. And he goes into it headlong. He throws some massive parties. He has some serious feasting. And in fact, if this is King Solomon, and you look back at the way kings used to throw parties, here's the kind of detail you'd be getting. You go back to 1 Kings 4, and here's the kind of provision or the daily things that were needed to chuck parties. Here's the kind of details. I dug it up for you, and here's what it was like, the daily provisions. He would have needed 600 kilograms of flour and oats, 30 cows, 100 sheep, 100 goats, 100 deer, 100 chickens. That's just the daily provision needed to put on the feast to chuck a party day in, day out for him and all of his guests. Serious wine, serious bread, serious meat. What else do you need, really? Carbs, protein, it's all there. Now, when you add up these kind of figures, chances are he was actually entertaining about 20,000 people a day. That's how many friends he had coming to join him in this partying, and he would do it all day, all night, night after night. When you consider that kind of party, it makes the kind of parties we throw seem pretty lame. You know, invite a few people over, you know, BYO meat, you know. I'll make the salad, you know. Oh, generous me. You know, Solomon would just be going, are you serious? That's a party? Dude, look, I'm just going to slaughter 30 cows and 100 more lambs. I'm just going to eat some. This guy knew how to party, and he gave himself fully to the task of pursuing just crazy parties, night after night, night after night. But then he soon moves on to something else because that obviously doesn't work. And you can kind of imagine how it might not have worked. No doubt it would have been a bit of a blast to start with. Everyone would have been having a ball. But then it only takes a couple of days before things to start to get a little bit repetitive and people to start to get a little bit bored. So you keep ramping things up, more food, more wine, more entertainment. I don't know how it went, but eventually it just gets boring, just gets repetitive. And he says there in verse 2, he says, laughter, though laughter may have some kind of therapeutic thing in it, laughter, he says, it's just, what does he call it? Madness. You can laugh your head off all night long. In fact, I went camping with my son Levi a couple of weeks back. I'd promised him I'd do that for months because he's just started school. And we went down to, what's it called? Not Pearl Beach, Patonga, a camping ground there. And we put up a tent, not much of a camper myself, but I did it, right? Because I'm a dad, I'm the dad of dads. Feeling pretty awesome, right? Put up this tent, we camped, and we tried to go to bed at a reasonable hour for a five-year-old. So we went to, you know, tried to get to sleep around 9 o'clock or something like that. But there was all these other families around us. And once their kids went to bed, that's when they started hitting the wine and beer and just partying. And so I'm sitting there in this tent, and there's no soundproofing in tents, is there? You just hear everything. So I lay there, I swear, from 9 at night till probably 2 in the morning. Like, I wasn't going to get chizzy at it. I thought I'd just let it roll. And while I just listened to people laughing their heads off, they were drunk as skunks, having what no doubt they thought was the best. They were having a fantastic time, and they were laughing and laughing and laughing. Sometimes I lay there just having a giggle too. I don't know what they were laughing at, but their laughs made me laugh. You know, but after an hour or two, it starts to get a bit repetitive, you know. What about doing it night after night after night? That's what he tries. He comes to the conclusion, yeah, it's all right a little bit, but it's just madness, really. Really, end result, madness. And so he moves on to doing something more productive, yeah? He takes on epic projects, that's what I'd call it. So he's determined to be productive. He's going to do something with his hands and his wealth. He's going to accomplish something. He's going to build something. No doubt so that he can... Chances are, after you build it, sit back and feel that sense of accomplishment that you can see what you've just built. You know, so he's going to do something more substantial. So verses 4, pick it up there. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water the groves of flourishing trees. Now, this is pretty serious. He doesn't just do a reno on his house. He builds houses, plural. If it is King Solomon, he took 14 years to build his own house. That's some serious detail. That's a serious kind of house. Plus, King Solomon built houses for all of his wives. One each, 700 wives. That's a whole suburb of houses and wives and families. I don't even know how that works, but the guys decided he's just going to build a... So that everywhere he looks, he's like, it's all mine. Everything you see, it's mine, I built it all. It's like he's got a monopoly on everything. And he doesn't just do houses, he does gardens and vineyards and farms that produce awesome fruit. He doesn't just go out and plant a little garden in his backyard, he plants parks and builds a forest. You don't build a forest, do you? Plant a forest. In fact, if you go to Jerusalem now, you can actually go to the pools of Solomon, the pools that he actually constructed so that they would feed water into his parks. You know, you can only imagine how he would scoff at what we do with our Better Homes and Gardens shows. You know, we watch the block and we just go, wow, that's insane. You know, King Solomon would look at the block and he'd just be like, is that all you've got? You know, just that little block, man, look at what I can build. He went after it. You think you come up with projects in your mind, you think you've done things with your life, you think you've got big plans, you're not going to come close to what he pulls off. Serious projects. But that obviously doesn't do it for him either, because he then moves on. After building, he obviously sits back and thinks, well, now I'm going to have to try to live in it and actually try to enjoy it. So that's the next phase. I call this the retirement phase, where you try to actually enjoy everything you've been working towards. And so then he dives in and tries to live the epic lifestyle, sit back and enjoy it all. Look at verse 7. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself from the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. So he takes to himself. He buys everything he needs to just service himself and his lifestyle. He buys slaves. You know, we have the service industry where we can pay someone to make us a coffee or a meal or give us a massage or go to the hairdresser. He had live-in baristas, a live-in chef, nanny, cleaner, masseuse, hairstylist, personal trainer. He had an entire team of people at his beck and call to help life work wonderfully. We buy a song and play it on our iPod. He hears something he likes or hears about it and he goes and buys the band and gets them to play for him in his private audience, you know. We buy a ticket and go to a stage production. He actually builds a theatre on his own property and creates his own production company and they play for his own private audiences. It's the kind of things that he does. We take to ourselves one wife or one husband with hopes and dreams of a certain amount of intimacy, sexual intimacy. He takes to himself 700 wives, 300 concubines. I don't even have a clue how that works. But basically, the picture is very clear. We've got a guy going after unlimited sexual experience. That's clearly what he's going after. Uninhibited sexual experience. The kind of setup that would make, that is the ultimate Playboy mansion and make Hugh Hefner look very, very lame indeed. So that's what he does. He just goes after it. Everything he wants. Supersizes it all. And he finishes it by saying, the delights of a man's heart. Anything I could think of, I went and I got it. He saturates himself in pleasure. You name it, he had it, owned it, did it, lived it. All the normal things that we pursue in life, just multiply it by 100 and that's what he got. Had all the good times and parties you might desire, all the friends and lovers you might dream of. He had the marriage, he had children. He had properties and projects and possessions and service and entertainment and retirement. He had it all. But look at his conclusion. You've got to see it. We've got to hear it. We've got to learn from it. Verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Now listen up. He does say that there is a certain amount of delight. What does he say there? My heart took delight in all my labor. So hear this. There certainly was a certain level of enjoyment in the process of the pursuit. Have you got that one? There is enjoyment. There is delight. There is a certain level of happiness and pleasure that will come in the process of the pursuit, as you're heading towards what you think is going to do it for you. But it's fleeting and it's momentary. And so he basically says, that was it. The reward for all my work was just a little bit of delight along the way. Or perhaps even a fair bit of delight along the way. But at the end, and this is the big question we're considering, what about at the end when you sit back and you ask about all that you toiled towards? What did it achieve? Well, it didn't last. He says, take it from a bloke who had everything. It doesn't last. It doesn't work. I've got a quote from Jim Carrey for you here. Not that Jim Carrey is the most qualified philosopher in the universe, but he actually does do a bit of philosophical reflections. We know him as the comedy guy, but obviously very successful in being an actor, a comedy actor. He says this, I wish everyone could get rich and famous and have everything they ever dreamed of so they would know that it's not the answer. Huh? Obviously, he's someone who got everything he ever dreamed of and came to the conclusion, well, that's not it. That's not it. Word from others. Even if you are able to finally get that picture-perfect family that you've ever dreamed of and have wonderful children that you have wonderful relationship with, I promise you, your deepest longings for life will not be satisfied in that. There will be pleasure along the way. There will be a certain level of enjoyment in all that, absolutely. But your deepest longings for life will not be satisfied in anything under the sun. That's what we need to hear from the teacher here. Look at verse 11. Here's where he says, you know, a certain amount of delight in all my labor, yet, that word yet, we've got to take notice of that. Verse 11, yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing gained under the sun. Basically, he's saying the ultimate end result is I'm left with nothing. Like chasing wind. You never get it. Like a vapor trying to grab a hold of it. Never get it. Hear this though, people. Pleasure is not the problem here. Don't hear me being down on pleasure. Don't hear the Bible being down on pleasure. In fact, the pursuit of pleasure is not the problem either. We're wired for goodness. We will pursue pleasure with every day of our lives. The issue is this, where and how we pursue it. That's where the issue lies here. You will pursue pleasure, but where will you pursue it? How will you pursue it? Because if we can heed the teacher's warning here, someone who has gone ahead of us, checked it all out, and then come back to tell us what it's like, his conclusion is life under the sun doesn't work. Meaning ultimate pleasure cannot be found simply in life under the sun. It's the equivalent of this. Say you're heading along a four-wheel drive track, but you're only in a two-wheel drive van with skinny wheels, little cheese cutters. Not that I've ever done anything like this, right? But you're heading along this track and someone comes back the other way in a souped-up four-wheel drive that can handle everything. And they come up to your window, they wind it down and they say, just so you know, we got bogged time and time and time and time again. We couldn't make it, so we had to turn around and come back. And you've got a choice, don't you? You can either listen and go, thanks for that, that's awesome. I'm not going to go down there in my van, in my passenger vehicle. I won't do it. Or you can say, oh, good on you, mate. Phew, I'll give it a go. I'll be right. You must have done something wrong, mate. I'll be right. No. We need to heed the teacher's warning here. Ultimate pleasure cannot be found simply in life under the sun. And here's why. Life under the sun is broken and corrupted by sin. That's why. And it's completely corrupted. We live in a broken world. We are broken people. And so the pursuit of life under the sun will be constantly frustrated. Romans 1 tells us very clearly the impact of sin on our lives. Sin means we exchange God for created things. Meaning this, instead of seeking pleasure in God, the one who is above the sun, we seek pleasure in his stuff, that which is below the sun. And we find ourselves, because of our corruption, starting to settle for temporary, fleeting pleasures instead of the eternal, everlasting satisfaction of our God. I've got a quote here from C.S. Lewis. He writes so many good things apart from the Narnia series. Here's a quote from his book, The Weight of Glory. If you haven't read Weight of Glory, you've got to read it. You got that quote there for me, Sean? Here he is. Look what he says. It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition while infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. It's normal that we desire pleasure, but you can completely get it wrong where you pursue it. We are to find it in the one who made us. We're to pursue pleasure in the one who is the God of pleasure. Don't settle. Don't be far too easily pleased by gaining a little bit of delight along the way and thinking that's enough. A little bit of enjoyment in the process. It's not enough. You are built for so much more. You are built to know and live in the one who made you and invented pleasure. It's almost like this. It's almost like we can spend our entire lives pursuing life, bumping around in a dark room, the dark basement of a house. Yeah? Going after life, bumping around in a dark basement of a house, where all the time being unaware that the house even exists, or that there's a yard and a world outside the house that is above you. And actually, when Solomon here, or the teacher here, is investigating life under the sun, it's life in the basement. Banging around, pursuing pleasure, getting a certain amount, unaware of what's above. Unaware of what God has made us for. Unaware of the real life we can be swept up into. Jesus makes it really clear, and I'll get you to come here with me. Come to John chapter 4. Jesus makes it really clear where satisfaction can be found, where contentment can be found, where real pleasure can be found. He makes it abundantly clear. Come to John 4, which is one of my favorite interactions that Jesus has with someone on the road. He bumps into a woman, a Samaritan woman, at a well. And as you do when you're at a well, you talk about water, right? So he starts talking about water with this woman at the well. And he asked the woman to actually get him a drink. And we don't know if she got him a drink. I think she did. But then as she's getting him this drink, he interacts with her and he says something to the effect of this. He says, "If you knew who I was, you'd ask me for a drink and I would give you living water." Now, it just goes completely overhead. She doesn't understand what he's talking about. He's jumped to this new spiritual kind of level. And she just looks at him and goes, "Man, you haven't got a bucket. How are you going to give me this living water?" Yeah? She doesn't get it, but he keeps going because he wants her to hear something. She's a thirsty woman, not just physically thirsty. She's emotionally, spiritually thirsty. He knows what's gone on for her. She has been pursuing life in all the wrong places, and it is damaging her terribly. You can read more about it, right? But he wants her to know where true satisfaction can be found. He wants her to know where her thirst can be quenched. And so look at verse 13 of what Jesus says. "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I will give them will never thirst again. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." You see what Jesus is doing with her? He's saying, look, life under the sun, anyone who comes and just drinks this water, this physical water, there'll be some level of delight and satisfaction in it, but you will be thirsty again. He says, but you come and drink the water that I can give you, living water. He's talking about a spiritual thing here. He's talking about relationship with him, effectively. You drink that water, you'll never thirst again. There's real satisfaction to be found. There's real happiness, deep, lasting happiness and pleasure that can be found in him, in the one who made us. Now, we hear those words sometimes, and we hear it in other places in the scriptures, and sometimes we can know it, but we don't pursue it. Are you with me? And I think often if you're someone who knows this, you've heard this, yeah, I know pleasure's in Jesus. What matters is that you actually trust it enough to pursue pleasure by going to Jesus and pursuing him. Because if you don't pursue him, you're displaying that you don't really trust that that's where pleasure is found. We need to trust that our God is the author of good things. He is not the enemy of delight and goodness. He is not the cosmic killjoy. He came up with pleasure as his idea. Think back to the Garden of Eden. He makes a man and a woman, they're naked in the garden to just romp and roam and enjoy life. He came up with the idea of pleasure. Sounds fantastic. He says, come to me and be filled. He knows what pleasure is about. Friends, there is nothing under the sun that brings true lasting pleasure. We must look beyond the sun to find it and pursue pleasure, deep happiness and joy in knowing the one who is the giver of pleasure. Are you someone who pursues Jesus? Are you someone who goes after pleasure by going after him with your time and your energy and all of your resources? Can you apply yourself and pursue him? And I do want to finish up here by getting practical, because this is the kind of thing that you can kind of go, yeah, cool, right, go after Jesus, good. And then we just, I don't know, you just kind of leave it there and it's just floating around. I want to offer some ideas about what this might mean practically for you to be a better pursuer of pleasure by being a better pursuer of Jesus. And this will mean something different for all of us, I'm assuming, because we're all in different places. The question you need to ask is, what does it mean for me, where I am right now, to go after Jesus? So you've got to be honest about where you're at with things. Don't try and you don't need to pretend with anyone about where you're at. Actually, you just, where are you at? What's it going to mean for you to move and take a step towards Jesus from where you are and pursue him more seriously with more of your energy, with more of your time, with more of your resources, to go after him seriously? What's it going to mean? I want to suggest a couple. For some of you, some of you who are really new to all these things, you've been dragged in here tonight, you're really not sure about what I've been rabbiting on about for half an hour. For you, I'd recommend, if you really want to pursue pleasure, investigate this more. Look into this some more. Look into this Jesus some more. We have lots of ways that you can kind of do this here in church, but you don't have to follow any kind of certain thing that we tell you to do. You just go after him. You talk to people who know him. Do whatever you can to find out more about this. Nath did mention life. It's already started 1 week, but you can jump in on the second week. But whatever you do, investigate Jesus some more. What the conclusion you come to about Jesus will be the most important conclusion that you make in your life, if this is truly where pleasure is found. Second, you might be someone who has been checking this out for a little while. You've been looking into this. You've been speaking to people. You've been doing your homework. You've been trying hard to figure it out. And maybe you're at the point where you need to make a decision. You need to repent and believe. You need to turn from your sin and turn to Jesus. And perhaps tonight is the night where you actually need to do that. Or very soon is the time when you need to do that. Decide, I'm with him. I'm not just going to keep checking him out forever. I'm going to make a decision to be with him and follow him and know him and trust in him. Maybe that's you. Do that. Do that. If you're someone who has already trusted in Jesus, and I know many of us have, how seriously are you continuing to pursue him from where you're at right now? Where could you be more serious in your pursuit? Do you need to be spending more time with him? Has that just kind of drifted? Been a while since you've read and prayed on your own. Been a while since you've had some really seriously good time with him. But you know that to do that, you're going to need to drop some other things to make some serious time to be with Jesus. Drop those things. Drop those things. Go after him. Spend time with him. Make time for him. You might be someone who's holding back on serving him and his people. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why we can be so busy. But maybe some of those things are just more about you, pursuing you and pleasure in you, and you need to drop some of those things to pursue him in service of him and enjoy serving him with his people. Maybe you just need to get a whole lot more fully involved and devoted to his things. Dive into his things. Maybe you need to get some help to do that. Ask for it. Ask for it. Whatever you do, get practical. Go after Jesus more seriously than you have been, because that is where pleasure is found. And he made you for it. It's in him. Deep, lasting happiness, pleasure in him, now and for all eternity. Let's trust him.